Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Jeffrey Toobin on Madoff and the Mets. Can music really help heal the body from disease? And Brooke Gladstone on narrative bias in the news media, how we want to tell a good story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, even if the story doesn't have one. Toobin on Madoff in 60 seconds after a quick reminder that we are in our spring membership drive, everybody, and we humbly request that everyone who listens to us on a regular basis make a once-a-year contribution to help run the radio station. It takes full participation to do this. This is our second of three membership drive weeks this year, and we hope many of you will do a good deed right here, right now. Get it out of the way. Make your tax-deductible donation for 2011. Thank you very much for considering it. Visit our website at WNYC.org. See all our thank you gifts there, including the full-year subscription to The New Yorker. Or call our pledge line, 1-888-376-WNYC. That's 1-888-376-9692. And again, thanks a lot for considering it. Your support helps keep us strong no matter what blows in the economics or political winds. 1-888-376-WNYC or pledge online at WNYC.org. Thank you so, so much. My first guest this hour is The New Yorker magazine contributor and CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. His featured story in the brand new edition of The New Yorker is about Bernie Madoff's relationship with Fred Wilpon, owner of the New York Mets. And there's even a little about how one of Madoff's victims was the legendary Dodgers pitcher Sandy Koufax. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian.
And here on this morning after another embarrassing Mets implosion in a Mets-Yankee Subway Series game, I think most people know Wilpon is being sued by the lawyer representing Madoff victims as one who profited from rather than lost in the Madoff Ponzi scheme, a net winner, as they call it. Why did you decide to tackle this corner of Madoff world for The New Yorker?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that Picard, the bankruptcy trustee, is not treating Wilpon and Company and all of the related investors as just like any other person who made money from Madoff. He's treating Wilpon as if Wilpon were virtually an accomplice. He is not trying to take the profits that Wilpon made with Madoff. He's trying to take his principal. And that's a huge, huge difference in terms of the financial threat to the Wilpon company and, of course, to the Mets. And that's what really struck me as interesting and why I pursued the story.
Was Fred Wilpon a net winner in Madoff's Ponzi scheme?
He was, and there's some disagreement about how much money he made, but something in the order of $150 million, which is, of course, a great deal of money, but it is nothing compared to the $1 billion in principal that he had with Madoff, and that's what Picard is suing him for, and that's why Wilpon is facing this mortal threat to his business and to his baseball team.
For me, the most interesting part of your story is actually the narrative of the two families' long friendship, which we'll get into a little bit. But bottom line on the lawsuit, I don't think you take Picard's charges very seriously, do you?
I mean, I certainly take them seriously in the sense that they exist and they are a real threat. I'm skeptical of the case against Wilpon. I think that treating him as if he knew or should have known that Madoff was running a Ponzi scheme is really a stretch. I mean, when you consider that he had 20-plus years – if Wilpon had 20-plus years dealing with Madoff, there had never been a problem. Madoff was a respected leader in the financial community. He was chair of the NASDAQ. He'd been investigated and cleared by the SEC. I think Picard's charges really are a stretch. So, yes, I'm skeptical, but, you know, they exist, and they are – you know, a major, major threat to the future of the Mets at this point.
The pro-Wilpon evidence that you cite includes that he kept more than $500 million in the Madoff accounts, not something you would presumably do if you thought the guy was running a con game, and that on the very day, I didn't know this detail before, on the very day Madoff was arrested, after the arrest, Wilpon's company deposited another $1 million with Madoff before the news got to them. So they were feeding the beast as late as that, only to see the money evaporate. How convincing a detail is that?
I think it's a very convincing fact. I mean, look, even if you assume Fred is a bad guy, why would he keep more than half of his liquid assets in the world in a fund that he thought was a Ponzi scheme or suspected or even had a clue was a Ponzi scheme? I mean, even if you assume that he is a rational bad guy, that would be a crazy thing to do. And as you point out, you know, he was feeding the beast right up until the very last day that Madoff was free.
Jeffrey Toobin from The New Yorker on Madoff and the Mets, his cover story in The New Yorker this week. You, on the other side, you interviewed Madoff himself by phone to his prison cell phone, and he defended the Wilpons as innocent dupes, but he said something really curious, that he explained the strategy to Wilpon and his partner Saul Katz, the strategy he was using to invest the money. And Madoff says he was sure Wilpon didn't understand it. But what do you take that to mean, that he somehow explained the Ponzi scheme?
No, I mean, look, Brian, talking to Bernie Madoff, as I did many times for this story, is a very bizarre experience because he has drawn this crazy distinction in his mind about this system that he set up in the 80s, which he persists in saying was a good way to manage money. But and it was a complicated system of hedging. But he acknowledges, he stopped using that system in sometime in the 90s and was just running a straight Ponzi scheme. So he basically said, you know, I explained that early system to Fred, and they didn't really understand it. But you should recognize that they really didn't know what was going on. I mean, the levels of self-delusion and, frankly, craziness that are still present in talking to Bernie Madoff are profound. So it wasn't that he explained the Ponzi scheme. He explained the earlier system that right. no longer that he wasn't using for at least 15 years and maybe as long as 25.
Madoff did say to you that he believes the big banks and hedge funds that he did business with must have realized that it was a Ponzi scheme with their sophisticated auditing, which Wilpon didn't have, and are therefore complicit. That's even more interesting to me. Did he convince you of that?
Well, you know what? I have to say I am unsure about that. It is certainly much more plausible that the banks and financial institutions that dealt with Madoff on a regular basis had some clue that this was a fishy scheme. Because, you know, they would exchange data, financial records, in a way that Fred and his partners did not. And in fairness to Picard, the trustee, they are also looking to these banks to get a lot of money back. And those cases are proceeding at the usual slow pace of the legal system. But I mean, I agree with you that it is an interesting possibility that the banks and funds were complicit, but certainly there's been no proof of that yet.
Is Picard, the trustee, going after any big banks in the way he's going after Wilpon?
He is. I mean, some of those cases are proceeding along, and those are very deep pockets, and so he may ultimately get some significant money from them.
Now, also on the anti-Wilpon side of this case, the new news in the last few days is that Wilpon reportedly shopped for fraud insurance on his Madoff holdings, and Picard maintains that even though Wilpon didn't buy the insurance, it meant he must have had a suspicion that something was rotten in Denmark and did nothing about it, leaving him liable for other people's losses. What do you think about that revelation?
I have to say, I find that revelation less than earth-shaking. I mean, if you look at what happened, somebody tried to sell a partner in Wilpon's business insurance that would have covered fraud. He did not buy that insurance. It was apparently a solicitation from the insurance agent. I mean, he was trying to sell something. It wasn't like the Wilpons were out there shopping for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that not especially incriminating fact, but it is a fact, and people can weigh it in the bargain.
Jeffrey Toobin on his New Yorker cover story on Madoff and the owners of the Mets, and really, you wrote a very sad story here about a long friendship between two generations in their families and the Wilpons coming to grips with the fraud perpetrated on them by their friend. How close were they?
Well, they were pretty darn close. I mean, you know, I have to say, to me, the most poignant moment in reporting this story for the New Yorker was when I interviewed Jeff Wilpon, who is Fred's son and the chief operating officer of the Mets, and it was through Jeff that Fred met Bernie. Jeff and Mark Madoff were both at Roslyn High School together, and they really became very close friends. They spent every New Year's Eve together, and it was and even more than Bernie and Fred, Jeff and Mark were close friends. And because when the scandal broke, the lawyers told Jeff, stop contact with Mark, that really caused a very serious emotional breach between Jeff and Mark. And of course, as everyone probably remembers, on the second anniversary of Bernie's arrest, Mark killed himself.
Yeah.
And Jeff Wilpon is really haunted by that. And just, I'm sorry to go on a little bit of a tangent there, but, you know, Bernie and Fred mostly saw each other in Palm Beach, where their wives, where they both had summer homes. You know, they were friends. They both were almost exactly the same age. They both grew up in the outer boroughs, made it big in the big city. I don't think they were intimate friends, but they were definitely friends.
And Fred Wilpon must feel really bad for, among many other reasons, that he got his old friend, the legendary baseball pitcher Sandy Koufax, involved.
You know, Brian, I have been a journalist for a number of years, and I interview famous people for a living. But when I interviewed Sandy Koufax, I thought I was going to hyperventilate on the phone. I mean, it was so exciting for me to talk to Sandy Koufax.
We're terrible that way. I was getting chills the one time I had Yogi Berra in the studio.
There you go. You know, it's just nothing like guys who grow up as sportsmen.
That's right.
And you know, Koufax is still, you know, has that mystique of the guy who quit at the peak of his career. And then he didn't exactly disappear, and he didn't exactly become reclusive, but he is certainly not a ever-present figure in the news media. And Sandy Koufax, even though he lost a significant amount of his money with Madoff, you know, someone he was introduced to by Fred, could not have been more supportive for Fred, and could not have been less bitter and held less of a grudge against Fred for it. And it was really very striking. They're old. Fred and Koufax are really old friends, and it really makes a difference.
And Koufax, arguably the best pitcher in the top very few in all of baseball history, pitched at a time when they did not make the huge money that they make now, even at the very top of the game. And he told you that the Madoff money that he thought he had basically allowed him to do what he wanted rather than what he had to do. And this is, you know, Sandy Koufax. Does that mean that perhaps the greatest pitcher in baseball history in his old age suddenly has to work again to make ends meet?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think Sandy Koufax is you know, destitute by any means, and he has contracts for autograph companies and whatnot that provide him with a comfortable income.
Right.
But you're certainly right that, you know, Sandy Koufax never made $200,000 a year in his career, which ended in the mid '60s. You know, the amount of money that was flowing to the players in those days, I mean, you can only imagine what today Sandy Koufax would be making in
baseball.
But
think about what the bad pitchers make today in baseball.
I mean, you know, $100 million contracts have become routine, and here's, you know, arguably for a 5-year period, the best pitcher in the history of the game,
and just,
you know, never even made $200,000.
Right. Just for good measure, and we're just about out of time, but you got some little baseball scoops in this article, all quotes from Wilpon, kind of dissing his best Mets players. He says David Wright is not a superstar. Jose Reyes won't get the really big bucks in his next contract negotiation because he gets injured too much. And Carlos Beltran, he's 65% to 75% of what he was. If he set out to purposely demoralize his best three players, he couldn't have given better quotes. Do you think that he thought that you wouldn't publish the baseball quotes because you were writing a Madoff article?
It could be. I don't know. I mean, Fred is a stand-up guy. Fred, I was sitting there taking notes as he was talking. He's not used to you know, talking baseball with reporters very much. But, I mean, if you look at what he said about these players, I doubt that any Met fan who follows the game at all closely would disagree with any of those comments. I mean, they struck me as very rational, if somewhat unsentimental comments about, yes, you know, the state of the team.
Right. True, though not very motivational. Anyway, fabulous article in The New Yorker, the most featured cover story this week on Madoff and the Mets. Jeffrey Toobin, New Yorker Magazine staff writer and CNN legal analyst, thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.